Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 312 for April 17th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes...
I'm trying to allow people who have just come off the plane, may not have any Japanese skills at all, I'm trying to allow them to be able to access these drinks and this sort of what I think is a fairly unique drinking culture.
That's Chris Bunting, who blogs about Japanese whiskeys at Nonjata, and his new book on Japan's drinking culture has just been published. We'll discuss drinking Japan, along with the impact of the Japanese earthquakes on the country's whiskey distilleries later on, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Maker's Mark celebrated the final Thoroughbreds and Redheads weekend this weekend in Lexington and Loretto. As I reported back in January, Maker's Mark has decided to come up with a new event for its ambassadors starting next year. And it comes as Maker's Mark President and CEO Bill Samuels Jr. hands over the reins officially to his son Rob. Bill was honored twice this week before the party began. The Wine and Spirits Wholesalers Association honored Bill with its Sidney Frank Award at its annual convention in Orlando, and the Kentucky Distillers Association named Bill as a lifetime honorary member of the KDA board. By the way, only four other people have received that honor. The last one was Bill's father, T. William Samuels Sr., back in 1982 when he retired and turned things over to Bill. The other three, Dr. Frank Krause of Barton Distilling and later on at Jim Beam, Charles King McClure of the old Stitzel Weller Distillery in Louisville, and James Bigstaff O'Rear of the long-gone Shenley Distilleries. By the way, you can hear my exit interview with Bill in episode 298. Just check the WhiskeyCast archives from January of this year. The UK's royal wedding is just a couple of weeks away, and so far only two commemorative bottlings have been announced. The English Whiskey Company has already sold out of its first batch of its royal wedding bottling and is preparing a second batch for release around May 4th. This week, the Macallan announced its limited edition. The expression comes from two casks filled on April 29th in 1996 and 1999, the birth years for Prince William and Kate Middleton. Just 1,000 bottles will be available at the distillery's visitor center and for online sales in the UK only at the Macallan website at a price of £150 each or about $245. Kilhoman has released its Spring 2011 Isla Single Malt. It's the sixth single malt release from Kilhoman. This one is a vatting of 3- and 4-year-old malt aged in bourbon casks, then finished off in vintage Oloroso sherry casks for 5 weeks before bottling. It's been bottled at 46% ABV and should be reaching retailers now. Weems Malts has released two updated versions of its Peat Chimney and Smooth Gentleman blended malts. Peat Chimney is blended around an Islay malt base, while the Smooth Gentleman's Fingerprint malt is a Highlander. Both expressions are at least 8 years old, bottled at 40% ABV. I'll have tasting notes for both of them on the WhiskeyCast website soon. Back in November, we heard about Washington's Dry Fly Distilling in episode 289. Dry Fly has now been named Distillery of the Year in the American Distilling Institute's annual awards. The Institute focuses on craft distillers, and Hogshead Whiskey from McMenamin's Edgefield Distillery in Oregon won best-in-class honors for whiskeys. Woodford Reserve is now taking bids for three of its special $1,000 mint julep cups. It's the sixth year that the Kentucky Derby's official bourbon has created the charity juleps to be served at the Derby. There are 100 sterling silver cups available for purchase. The three being auctioned have additional 24-karat gold trimming. Proceeds from the sale of the mint juleps will benefit the Heart of a Horse Foundation, which works to rescue abused and neglected horses. There's a link for more details at the WhiskeyCast website. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Unnecessarily well-made. Let's check out the emails of the week now, brought to you by Johnny Walker. Chris Middleton emailed me from Australia this week with a correction. In the last episode, I mentioned the arrival of Lark Distillery's whiskies in the U.S. and said that Lark was the first licensed distillery in Australia. I should have known better. Chris has been working on a book covering the history of Australian distilling, and here's what he had to say. Bell Lark's distillery was not the first legal distillery in Australia, as you stated. It was the first registered distillery in the state of Tasmania since January 1, 1839. A prohibition on distillation was enacted by the local government, as the Tasmanian industry was uneconomical during the 1830s. A committee recommended to no longer subsidize the two remaining distilleries with differential duties. You'd have to laugh at one of the last distillers in the colony, James Hackett of Franklin Rectifying Distillery, who advertised his gin and cordials with a candidness that would be unacceptable today. An example, Christmas. It is a time of annual rejoicing, an opportunity to increase hallucination. Emphasis his. Australia had over three dozen extinct whiskey distilleries before the 1990s when Bill started. Now there are another dozen making malt whiskey around the country. By my estimation, between 1821 to 1985, as much as 13 million liters of whiskey were produced, 3.4 million gallons. Australia's whiskey heartland was Victoria, producing over 85%, followed by South Australia. Australia even exported Corio whiskey to America in 1934 to help meet the demand after Prohibition. There have been numerous brandy distilleries, still some large ones operating in South Australia, rum distilleries, Bundaberg Distillery in Queensland, which is Australia's largest distillery and second most popular spirit behind Jim Beam, plus numerous vodka, schnapps, gin, and liqueur distilleries are found across the country. Unfortunately, people now entering the micro-distilling business bring no knowledge of the distilling history and magnitude of the business before their time, so you would not have a snowball's chance in hell to know these facts. I've been researching and writing a book on this subject for over 2 years, so I'm in a unique position to have rediscovered our lost distilling and whiskey history. Quite a story is emerging. By the way, Shackleton's whiskey stash in Antarctica included two cases of brandy made at the Hunter Valley Distillery in New South Wales circa 1904. The distillery closed by the early 1940s. Kind regards, Chris. Well, needless to say, I'm grateful for the correction and the details. Thanks, Chris, and I can't wait to see that book when it comes out. Now, if you have a question, a suggestion, or a correction, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, or you can post your comments for everyone to see at the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. You may still be able to get tickets for some of the Spirit of Speyside Festival events. It runs April 28th through May 2nd in the Speyside region of Scotland. Bourbon's Bistro in Louisville will hold a bourbon and cigar dinner on May 2nd. Nichols and Perks in Stourbridge, England will host a tasting of American whiskeys on May 6th. The Trollhättan Whiskey Festival is May 7th in Trollhättan, Sweden. The U.S. chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society will hold its final single malt extravaganza of the spring on May 12th in Denver. And May 14th will be a busy day with Whiskey Live's Irish debut in Dublin and the Spirit of Toronto Festival. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Auchentoshan. The last time we heard from Japanese whiskey blogger Chris Bunting was in January of 2010. Back then, he was working on a book about his adopted country's drinking culture. After a lot of research, Drinking Japan is available now, and I caught up with Chris this weekend.
Well, I've been working on it. It seems like ages. I've been working on it for about 3 years now, including quite a lengthy time waiting for it to actually get printed and get onto bookshops and things. So it's basically a guide. It's fundamentally a guidebook to drinking in Japan. So it's a practical guide. It offers people language guidance. It goes around bars and picks out particular menu items and drinks they might consider trying to look at. But it's also organized according to particular drinks. So I've got a a beer chapter, a wine chapter, a whiskey chapter, which is, obviously is the area that I've been most sort of specialized in, a shochu chapter, which is the sort of indigenous Japanese spirit, an awamori chapter, which is a spirit from the southern islands in Okinawa, and obviously a sake chapter too. So it's organized according to that, and I've got bars. I've got a section with recommended bars that I've visited and sort of reviews of each bar. But at the start of each section, there's quite a long introduction to each drink, which looks at the history of the drink in Japan and its sort of current culture and how it's made and how it can be drunk and things like this. What I hope it is probably the first sort of really comprehensive attempt in English to look at the whole of Japanese drinking culture. There's some really superb books about sake in particular, and there's been books, for instance, by Ulf Buxrud about Japanese whiskey, for instance. But I don't think there's really been an attempt to look at it in the round and the whole of Japanese drinking culture. And I hope it does that successfully. And I think there's quite a lot to be learned by looking at particular drinks in that broader context. There's also a big chapters at the start that talk about the history of Japanese alcohol in general. There's a chapter talking about more practical things about types of drinking establishments. There's an appendix at the back that sort of goes through some language that people can use to try and get people up and running. Because the other side of it, going back to the practical guide thing, is I'm not really trying to write for people like me who've been in Japan for a fair while now, who might sort of have a good idea how to get the drinks they like. I'm trying to allow people who have just come off the plane, may not have any Japanese skills at all, I'm trying to allow them to be able to access these drinks and this sort of what I think is a fairly unique drinking culture and special drinking culture.
Now, you've listed in here reviews for your favorite bars, and I count up something like 122 of them. You've been around a lot, haven't you, Chris?
Yeah, I went to more than 122.
These are the best 122, right?
I just heard a comment from somebody who said that the research had been extensive and might have taken a toll on my liver. So I went to a few places. They're the best 122, and I went to all of them. So.
And these are bars that the average person would not know where to look for some of these places, right? These are some literally hole-in-the-wall type bars where only a few people get in, right?
Yeah, there's a sort of a range. Some of them are really famous bars. Which people, you know, that you and some of them are featured in the main guide. So, not far from where I am now, there's a place called the Lion Ginza Bar, which is a big sort of beer hall, and is really famous. But some of the other ones are really, really small. You know, one person establishments with I think the smallest one had four seats in it, a little wine bar in Kyoto. So, yeah, there's a big range. Now, not all of them are completely obscure, but some of them are.
Now, what does one need to know if you're not Japanese and you're visiting for the first time? What does one need to know to get along in the drinking culture there?
That's a good question. The first thing, and I think this is what the book's trying to say, is to understand the diversity of it. I think for a lot of people who are interested in whiskey and might be listening to this podcast will know that Japanese bars, whiskey bars, are very good. But there are, what I'm trying to get through to people is that there's also these other areas that are just as energetic and full of life that are completely separate from that. So there are shochu bars with hundreds and hundreds of bottles of shochu available, and then there are awamori bars with sort of music and things and sort of lots of different types of awamori. So it's the first thing I would say is to understand the diversity of it. And I don't think, you know, if you're only here for a week or two, you can't try all of that diversity. But what I would urge people to do is just not just to go to the, say, a whiskey bar and or, say, one of the craft beer places, which, you know, I often go when I'm just wanting to relax, I often go to a sort of a beer pub in Tokyo because it's sort of relaxing. But what I'm trying to urge people to do is to push themselves a little bit and try some of these other areas like awamori or sake or shochu, because really that's a large part of the drinking culture.
And as you point out, it really does make sense to try some of the other things like the shochu and the awamori,
yeah,
just to get a sense of the culture.
I think so, and also to understand. So if you're interested in whiskey, for instance, and you'll find that in Japan you often will be offered mizuwari and things like this, and even whiskey or yuwari. So mizuwari is a sort of mixed water and ice and whiskey, and oyuwari is sort of warm hot water and whiskey. These are now pillars of Japanese whiskey culture, but they come from these other areas. So to understand them, to fully understand Japanese whiskey, for instance, I think you need to understand some of these other cultures. And in these, for instance, these other spirits, you know, awamori and shochu have really long histories which are comparable to whiskey in say Scotland or Ireland or brandy in France. You know, the length of the history is comparable. So they have entrenched cultures.
Now, when this book started out, it did not start out as a charity project, but with the recent earthquake and tsunami and the disasters that have followed, it has now become a charity project in essence, right?
It has. Well, what I felt was we were planning to bring this out, obviously now, and so we were right on the final stages of getting it all ready, and then this calamitous event happened. And the first thing to say is, I've put half of what I earn from the book to Japan earthquake relief, to specifically to the Red Cross, Japanese Red Cross. And this is just really for me to make me feel better, because I just thought there was slightly ridiculous and sort of almost obscene thing to be seeking to sort of promote a book like this about something so trivial as drinking culture at a time when tens of thousands of people have lost everything, and actually thousands of people have lost their lives. And it's really about me. I put a little thing on my website which is connected to the book trying to explain about this. If somebody wants to give money to Japan earthquake relief, it is not the most effective way to do it is not to give to buy my book, because an author's earnings on a book like this, without going into my personal finances, aren't the whole price of the book. And so if you want to give $20 to Japan Earthquake Relief, the best thing to do is to go straight to the Japanese Red Cross and give it. This is really more about me trying to make myself feel a little bit better and make it feel a little bit less obscene to be promoting a book at this time in Japan. I'm just hoping that I might increase the sales of the book just a little bit from people who might otherwise have bought it and would have been sort of wavering about whether or not they were interested in the book. This might encourage a few more people to buy it, and then it would increase my sort of donation by a little bit. But it's not really, I don't want to sort of paint it as a charity project, because, you know, as I say, the most effective way to give money to the earthquake relief is to pay directly to these organizations yourself.
But still, Chris, it's a very generous gesture on your part, and every little bit can help. And
yeah.
I wanted to also talk to you about this because you've been tracking what's happening with the Japanese whiskey industry post-earthquake. What do we know about the state of the industry? From what David Kroll at Whiskey Magazine Japan had been posting, it looks like all the distilleries came through pretty well unscathed, correct?
Yes, I think physically there was no serious damage to any of the distilleries. The two relevant ones are Miyagi-kyo Distillery just near Sendai, which is close to the sort of main epicenter of the earthquake, is in, and is definitely in the disaster zone. And the other one that is quite peripheral and a long way from the disaster zone, really, is the new Chichibu distillery, Ichiro Akito's Chichibu distillery in Saitama. But, and he received some very sort of minor damage to, I think, some fencing or something. And Miyagi-kyo, as I understand it, as you've said, that David Kroll has also has confirmed, it hasn't received anything more than a little bit of broken stock sort of stuff. And as I understand it, I got a letter from Miyake-san, who is the production manager at Miyagi-kyo, and he said that all the staff and all their families seem to be okay. So that's the situation. Fortunately, some of the sake breweries in these areas were wiped out. I mean, the situation with some of the sake breweries is really not very good at all. But the whiskey seems to have come through okay.
One of the big concerns in recent weeks has been the radiation coming from the nuclear plants near Sendai. Was there any radiation exposure at Miyagi-kyo that you know of?
Right.
I've had letters from listeners wondering, you know, whether it's in the evacuation zone or not, and you'd be better placed to know than I would.
Well, the first right. I've been trying to deal with this on Nonjata, as you probably know, and other people have been trying to deal with it. My understanding is this: it's a long way from the evacuation zone. The original, the current evacuation zone is 30 kilometers, I think, around the distillery.
Around the nuclear plant.
Around the nuclear plant. And Miyagi-kyo is a lot longer, further than that. I think we're talking about over 100 kilometers away. And actually, I may be underdoing that. So I'm taking that off the top of my head. But my understanding, so we're certainly not in that area. And the readings that the Japanese government has been taking the Japanese government has been trying to take readings in farms immediately outside the 30-kilometer zone, and looking at things like cabbages to see whether people can eat cabbages from certain areas. And as I understand it, there's one village where the radiation reading has exceeded the safety standard, and they're going to have to stop that village, which is way, way closer than Miyagi-kyo is. And they're talking about cabbages, which are, you know, obviously growing in the environment, rather than whiskey in a warehouse in a cask, up in the mountains. You know, because Miyagi-kyo is also behind some mountains away from this area. So, as I understand it, I think the thing is this will be dealt with in the fullness of time when full statistics come out. But I really think it would be really tragic if people's livelihoods were affected by sort of exaggerated fears that... my feeling is that, you know, there may be absolutely no effect at all, even on Miyagi-kyo, which would be the closest. And I had heard that some people were talking about other Japanese distilleries, even at completely outside this area. So, for instance, Yoichi in Hokkaido. Now, the thing we need to understand about the geography of Japan is that even though it looks like a small island, it's actually a really big place. The distance that Yoichi is from Fukushima is the sort of distance a part of Austria might be from a part of Holland. So we're talking about big distances. Even though it's up there in the north and it feels like it's all close together, it's not. So I don't think we can, and none of the other, and also basically none, no, the direction of the wind has been basically from north, I'm trying to get my directions, from the northwest pushing down, and on a few days it's pushed down towards Tokyo where I am, so maybe some of this radiation has landed on my head, but, you know, I really am really eager to try to get people to engage with the facts of what has happened, rather than a sort of general idea that, oh my God, it's all, you know, it's radiation, radiation, radiation. We need to stay away from that, because some of these areas, I mean, Hokkaido, for instance, has not had any significant increase of radiation at all in this situation so far.
I know we've heard anecdotal data about stores in some countries pulling Japanese whiskey off the shelves. And
yeah,
that would really be a tragedy, since there are many places that can't get Japanese whiskey, for those countries that do have access to it to pull it because of really unfounded fears, right?
Yeah, exactly. Especially given that some of those bottles
haven't been in Japan for several
thousands
years.
Of miles away, tens of thousands of miles away, and have, you know. But so anyway, exactly. I think we just have to. Japan is a developed country. It has received some criticism internationally in this crisis in dealing with the Fukushima thing, and no doubt the government has received very significant domestic criticism, but it is a country where the rule of law holds, and if there is a problem, there will be inspections, and then also the companies like Nikko Whiskey are responsible companies, so I don't think we're going to be I think we have to wait for the real facts about the distilleries, well, the distillery that might possibly need some fears addressed to do with.
One of the things I've noticed, or at least read in many cases about radiation in the past with nuclear accidents, is that in the case of fallout, unless it directly comes in contact with something, there's not going to be that much exposure. And as you pointed out earlier, we're dealing with whiskey that's being stored inside wooden casks inside a much larger warehouse. So the chances of whiskey being exposed to radiation are minimal at best, unless it was within that 30-kilometer evacuation zone, which none of the distilleries are in.
That's right. And even in the 30-kilometer evacuation zone, just to get this into some perspective, when it was actually going off, they initially had a 20-kilometer evacuation zone and a 10-kilometer zone where people have been asked to stay inside their houses. You know, so if people, human beings, staying inside their houses were considered, and by the way, the British government, that they were the advice I was following, was saying, you know, the Japanese government's advice is correct. You know, even people 21 kilometers from the plant when the explosions were happening, were being told that they were safe if they stayed inside their house. So, yeah, I think. But, I mean, the thing is, I don't want to also go the other side and paint myself as some sort of radioactivity expert. I don't know what I'm talking about. All I'm urging people to do is to, you know, if they don't know what they're talking about either, to sort of withhold judgment, at least. And wait till we actually have some facts and some sort of expert interpretation of those facts. But I think you're right.
To actually wait for facts before responding to something.
Yeah, it would seem a good idea.
There are links for Chris's Nanjata blog and his site for Drinking Japan at the WhiskeyCast website, and you can also order a copy through the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com. This week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth segment is brought to you by Auchentoshan, the triple distilled since 1823. It has a brand new website. I invite you to check it out at auchentoshan.com. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the distilleries Chris Bunting mentioned. As he said, Nika's Miyagigyo Distillery is the closest one to the main area of earthquake damage in Japan. The 10-year-old Miyagikyo single malt is available primarily in Europe as well as Japan. It's bottled at 45% ABV. The nose has dark chocolate, honey, and hazelnut notes, with touches of lemon peel and dried flowers. The taste starts off creamy before a cinnamon note develops and builds up to a peak. It fades to reveal the same dark chocolate, honey, and hazelnut notes from the nose that linger nicely through a soft and subtle finish. I'm giving the Nika Miyagikyo 10-year-old a score of 90. The Whiskey Fairy delivered a sample of White & Mackay's recreation of the McKinley's Rare Old Highland Malt that Sir Ernest Shackleton took to Antarctica more than a century ago. As far as I know, only Richard Patterson and Dave Broom have been able to taste both the old and the new versions. But if the replica is as close to the original as possible, then Shackleton had pretty good taste in his whiskey. The recreation is bottled at 47.3% ABV and includes whiskey from the Glenmore Distillery, which was one of the key malts in the original McKinley's. The nose is citrusy with touches of lemon and lime, green tea with honey, and hints of peaches, pears, and fresh berries. The taste is rich and buttery with a touch of green tea with lemon and honey, along with hints of cinnamon and ginger. The finish, light and tart with touches of lemon peel and spearmint, and it lingers nicely. This whiskey would be excellent in any century. I'm giving the recreation of McKinley's Rare Old Highland Malt a 91. Finally, I tasted a sample this week of Amrut Double Cask, bottled at 46% ABV. This limited edition is the oldest Amrut yet, with two casks matured for about 7 years, and an Angel's share after that point of almost 60% evaporation. The nose is strong and spicy with notes of black pepper, nutmeg, and toasted bread. The taste is thick and peppery with a hint of citrusy tartness balanced against a hint of brown sugar sweetness. The finish keeps that same balance with an added slight nuttiness and lingers nicely. I'm giving the Amrut Double Cask a score of 88. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. They're free to download thanks to support from the Glenrothes and Ben Romick. My notes are also at the WhiskeyCast website, along with the calendar of events, links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.